Okay, next we have a panel of two speakers. We have Karen Boyd and Fabio Marino. Karen Boyd is a founding partner at Turner Boyd LLP, representing clients in intellectual property matters. Fabio is a partner at McDermott Will & Emery, where he leads the IP practice for the Northern California offices. They'll be speaking about the uncommon defenses.
Okay.
Gentlemen first.
I was going to say ladies first, but I guess you got there first. So I guess it's Friday afternoon, and you're going to be hearing about oddball defenses in patent cases. And I'm sure that's what you were all waiting for. But Karen actually came up with the title, so you know,
so
I'm
going to tease me about
it. I'm going to tease her about it. So what we mean by oddball defenses are defenses that are not going to come up in every single patent case. But when they do come up, because the facts of that particular case call them into question, they can actually be dispositive. So they're very important for those cases in which they do apply. And we're going to talk about four of these defenses in some detail, and three we're going to touch upon primarily because they come out, they're pled a lot, even though they may not actually be applied in a lot of the cases, at least in our experience. So the first one I'm going to talk about is standing. And really, this is a combination of factors. So we all know that in order to assert a patent in litigation, you need to have standing, which means one of two things. You either have to be the owner, and actually in that case, you can sue in your own name, or you have to have substantially all of the rights that are required to assert a patent, in which case you can assert it, but chances are you're going to have to bring the actual patent owner as an indispensable party to the lawsuit. So where this becomes particularly dangerous for the plaintiff is when the patents aren't patents that the plaintiff developed in-house and had chain of ownership from the beginning. Typically, it's when patents are acquired for purposes of the litigation, or if there has been a transfer of patent rights between different corporate entities. And so this is something that every plaintiff should pay attention to before they decide to file a lawsuit. Because standing, as I think all of us who practice know, there is no substitute for it. You either have it or you don't. If you don't have standing the moment you bring lawsuit, that suit is going to get dismissed. And I will tell you, in my personal experience, this has come up four or five times during my career. Every single time, in the end, the lawsuit was dismissed due to lack of standing. So this is an analysis that's very important for plaintiffs to do in every single case, except you know, when the patent is organically developed at the client, in which case it's probably not going to be an issue. Now, what do we mean by substantially all the rights? So there is a fairly long list of rights that should be conveyed to the plaintiff, and the teaser is at the very end. If whatever instrument is used to transfer the patent rights to the plaintiff doesn't expressly assign one of these rights, the presumption is that right was retained by the transferor. So you're not actually going to have that right unless you specifically include it in the vehicle with which you're transferring right to the would-be plaintiff. And you know, things that people generally forget to include are things like the right to collect past damages. If you're going to be a plaintiff, that's an important one. Because you might be able, if you have you know, an assignment going forward, you might be able to bring suit and obtain damages going forward, but you won't get any damages for past infringement. So this is a comprehensive list of things. If you're not the original owner, if you don't get all of the rights, you should expressly include. Now, what happens if you have an assignment, it doesn't make you the complete owner, but you have sufficient standing to sue? What will typically happen is that you will have to join as an indispensable party the actual patent owner. This has come up in a number of cases in the Northern District over the last few years, particularly with assignments from foreign entity. For example, ITRI, which is the Ministry of Research in Taiwan, at some point over the last 15 years has sold a number of its patents, and they have a standard assignment upon which they retain some rights. But they've made it very clear that they will not appear as a plaintiff in a U.S. court. And so there are two cases in the Northern District, one that I've litigated, one that was litigated by somebody else. But in the end, even though the acquirer of the patent had standing to assert the patent, they could not continue the lawsuit without joining ITRI, which has a ministry in Taiwan, did not want to have any part of it. And the outcome of both cases was the case was actually dismissed for failure to join an indispensable party.
Are there weird conflict issues that you've ever seen come out in a situation like that where there's a sort of involuntary plaintiff that has to be brought in? Are there conflict issues with the attorneys that have ever bubbled up? I can imagine that.
Well, generally it doesn't get to that point, right? Because when this comes up is when the other party doesn't want to participate. So they can have their own lawyer. You don't have to represent them, but they'll just not show up. And so it's not really a question of conflict. It's a question of the defendant is going to assert quite rightfully that they would be exposed to a second lawsuit by the other owner. And that's why you need to bring all the indispensable parties.
Mm-hmm. So before we get to the prior user defense, I want to add a couple of things to the standing issue that Fabio just was talking about, because it usually is something that comes up pretty early, and it is something that those of us who represent defendants most of the time, it's worth taking a look at and deciding if it's something that bears further discovery. I am currently in the middle of a bench trial in San Francisco. That's in front of Judge Tiger, and he runs Monday through Thursday, and so I did Monday through Thursday this week, and I will do Monday through Thursday next week. So it is not quite a two-week bench trial solely on the issue of ownership of patents and other rights, and the case has been pending for almost 2 years. So this ownership, this standing issue, is one that is near and dear to my heart currently. And it's not always straightforward. When I've had a case litigating for 2 years and now trying for 2 weeks, first of all, that explains the bags under my eyes and how my sentences aren't quite coming out, but it is quite important. That is a bench trial right now because it is only on that one issue, and we managed to get it bifurcated, so we'll deal with that, and then we'll see what happens. This issue, the one that I'm supposed to be talking about, prior user defense, and if we don't get to all seven, it's okay,
we'll
right?
Okay.
It's okay. Is everybody okay with that? We don't get all seven? All right. All right, well, I just gave you another half on Fabio. So, the prior user defense, I think, is a defense that would be really good in a jury trial. I will confess, I have never tried this issue in a jury trial. I have it currently pleaded in a case that's still in discovery. Does anybody know what the prior user defense is? Hands? All right, it's a little bit what it sounds like. Like, the defendant says, hey, I've been doing this. What do you mean you're suing me for patent infringement? Before the AIA, the prior user defense, and that's it sounds a lot like an invalidity defense. It sounds like, okay, prior use, prior user, prior use, those sound similar. It's a little bit different. The prior user defense before the AIA only applied to business method patents. And so, understandably, I think very little was developed on the case before the AIA, or developed on the defense before the AIA. After the AIA, so for the last 5 years, it's very broad. It says you have this defense for this very broad subject matter, process that's consisting of machine, manufacture, or composition of matter, blah, 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 commercial process. All right, so what is this defense? So the statute, the citation is at the top of this. We haven't printed out on the slide the statute, 35 U.S.C. 273. It is a very, very long statute, especially in the patent code compared to other of the things in the patent code. And you have to read all of the words in the statute in order to figure out what in the world you can do with this defense. So the fundamental of the defense is I have been doing this thing that you have sued me on for more than a year before you applied for your damn patent. So why are you bothering me? Again, it's somewhat intuitive. I think it would be very appealing to a jury. But it's got a bunch of limitations. It's a clear and convincing evidence standard because it is sort of invalidity-like. It's got that same standard. You can't transfer it. If your company is acquired by another company, there's a lot of words in the statute. You've got to read all of them. And what it says is you have to have been doing this thing in the same place. So it's not something where if you're making widgets in a factory here, and then in a tiny factory here, and then Giant Co. acquires you, and then you make the widgets all over the country, the prior user defense doesn't follow the widgets. It stays in the one factory. In that same sense, it's not a general license. You can't have abandoned your commercial use. So if you made those widgets for a while back, a year before the patent was applied for, but then you stopped making your widgets for a while, and then you started again, and then you got sued, you don't have the defense anymore. If the patent is owned or assigned to a university, this one doesn't work for you, and you get attorney's fees awarded if you assert it unreasonably. Finally, it is technically a non-infringement defense. It is not an invalidity defense. I'm not sure it matters if you win, you win. Case law, there's very little. Nobody ever does it. It's an oddball defense. It's been denied a couple times on procedural issues. It has to be pleaded specifically. That's one of the things that's floating around in here. Again, if you read all the words in the statute, you see that it has to be pleaded. It has also been denied where you didn't have all of the elements of the patent claim. So that had been used in the prior use. Again, this how it transfers from entity to entity, it can't be a springing license sort of thing for acquisition. And there were a couple of cases before the AIA about this defense. I'm not sure how much vitality that case law has given the incredibly substantial modifications to the statute that were made with the AIA. Huge strategy issues. And I think most of us got to 273 and were like, this is too long for me to read. I'm just going to plead non-infringement and invalidity, and I'm going to be done with it. You need to think about if it conflicts with your non-infringement position. And this is very similar to if you're using your own product as a piece of prior art. You have that same potential tension. With this exception, the prior user defense says that you do not infringe if you've been using it. You do not infringe something that you otherwise would infringe if you've been using it. So there's this kind of dance where it doesn't really matter if you have infringed it or if you actually infringe it or not, because it's just what you would have done if you did infringe. It's a little bit fuzzy and a little bit weird, and there's some funny words, and there's no case law, but you're not admitting infringement by pleading this, and you're not admitting infringement. Ron?
The prior user expand the extent of the use 100-fold over what was prior and still assert the defense?
There are some words in the statute about where the use has to have been. And I think if it's just growth of a company, that probably would be found to fall within that. It's more about corporate acquisitions, that there is a statutory limit on it. But if it's just growth of the use within one company, I think you're probably still within the statute. You got to read all those words, though.
So actually, I have a question.
Yeah.
So when you say pre-AIA, post-AIA, is that with respect to the patent being filed under the AIA or just the date of enactment?
The date of enactment is my recollection. I haven't slept much recently, though. You might want to check that. If you have dependent claims and you are making changes to your product that for which you are claiming the prior user defense, if you're starting to, and if you start to infringe dependent claims and that doesn't go all the way back to a year before the patent was filed, you've got liability with regard to those dependent claims. So that's another thing to be thinking about when you're seeing if this might be something that you can use. And finally, there's this attorney's fees provision, which I think that's another reason that we only have two cases or three cases or whatever it is on this so far. It's a little bit scary. You look at that and you're like, oh, if I have unreasonably pleaded this, and it's a shall, it's like must be awarded. You have wiggle room in the reasonability part, but there's no wiggle room in the awarding of attorney's fees. So I'm not sure that we're gonna see the explosion of prior user defenses the way that we've seen the explosion of 101 defenses in the last couple of years, but I think it is worth looking at and considering, and that is what these oddball defenses are really about. And now I'm gonna pass the clicker.
Yeah, so my only comment on that defense is, you know, it's much like, you know, the old 102G defense, I invented it first. Even though technically you haven't conceded infringement, good luck convincing a jury after you plead that defense and argue it that you in fact do not practice the invention. So you better be sure that the infringement allegations are against the product exactly the same way as it existed a year before the patent was filed. Now, I'm going to talk about something called obviousness type double patenting.
It's my very favorite type of
patenting. Has anybody actually dealt with this in litigation? In litigation, okay. Two people, three people. Wow, that's more than I expected. Because I've done this for about 20-some years and never dealt with it before in the context of litigation, only in the context of prosecution. I'm dealing with it now because I inherited a case from somebody else and that defense was pled. So what is it? The objective of this rule is to prevent the patentee from improperly extending the patent term by filing suit.
From Italy. It's
it is. Yeah. San Benedetto. It's actually really good. But, you know, and this goes back to the days before GATT, right? Before we had 20 years from filing. I see a few faces here old enough to remember Lemelson, right? You know where Gerald Lemelson is? So there's a guy that filed a patent in 1958. And then he continued, every time he was going to get granted a new patent, he would file a continuation. And like, you know, when I started practicing in the early 90s, he was still filing lawsuits on this patent originally filed in 1958. And so his patent term, instead of 17 years, that stretched out for something close to 40-some years. So Congress, when it enacted, you know, new patent legislation after GATT, they said, well, wait a second, we're going to go to 20 years from filing. Doesn't matter, we only get 20 years. You're going to end this. This doctrine really developed before that point in time, where people could, in fact, get patent terms that went well beyond the 17 years. And what is the effect? That any patent that claims an invention that is not patentably distinct from an expired patent owned by the same entity is actually invalid. So the remedy is pretty draconian. The patent is altogether invalid. Now, there are three issues that are interesting here. First of all, there have been unintended consequences caused by the changing of the patent term. I'm going to go through that in detail because it creates a very awkward situation. Second, there's not a whole lot of case law that tells you what does it mean for an invention to be patentably distinct. And I'll tell you, it's a test that is rarely applied and probably for a good reason. And finally, and people actually forget about this, there is actually a safe harbor provision in 35 U.S.C. section 121 that prevents the application of the doctrine in certain cases. So let's talk about the unintended consequences first. So June 8, 1995, that's the date of enactment of GATT, for those, you know, didn't start practicing before that date, like me. And what that means is that patents that were filed before that date were entitled to either 20 years from filing or 17 years from issuance, whichever is longer. But if you file an application of one of those patents that were still eligible for the 17 years from issuance term, that continuation, even though it gets the same priority date, will expire 20 years from the filing of the original application it claims priority to. So think about this. You have a patent filed right before that date that gets 17 years from issuance. will expire in 2012, You file a continuation the following day. That second patent will expire 20 years from the filing date. So let's say the filing date was 1990. The continuation will expire in 2010, 2 years before the original patent. So what does that create? An awkward, the exact opposite situation of what the rule was intended for. The rule was intended to prevent you from extending the term, but if you have that situation of a continuation filed right after, of a patent was granted on an application filed before the date, the child will expire before the parent. And so what people are doing is they're applying the child against the parent. And you can see how that could be problematic. It's exactly the opposite of what the doctrine was intended to cover. Now, for those of you who have dealt with this issue in prosecution, you know that the first thing you do when you get an obviousness type double patent and rejection is you file a terminal disclaimer. You can actually file a terminal disclaimer after, you know, the patent has been granted. But you have to do it before the patent actually expires. So if this is a potential issue in your case, you need to analyze it fully because you might still be able to cure it by filing a terminal disclaimer even though the patent is already issued. Now, what does it mean for an invention to be patentably distinct? This is actually analyzed somewhat in the MPEP, the Manual of Patent and Examination Procedure. And there are two tests. There's a one-way test and a two-way test. And the MPEP gives you a whole bunch of reasons when you apply one versus the other. But the one-way test is pretty straightforward. You look at the claims of the asserted patent, and you see if they're obvious over the claims of the expired patent. Then you stop there. It's a one-way test. Two-way test, you do it both ways. You look at the expired patent versus the original patent and vice versa. Here is the tricky part. Even though it's an obviousness type analysis, it's an obviousness type analysis that only takes into account the claims. The specification, which in an obviousness defense would be considered, cannot be considered. It can only be considered to the extent it is necessary to construe the claims. So it's patently distinct. Even though it looks like obviousness, it's really comparing one invention to the other. And inventions, of course, are defined by claim. So it's very awkward, and it's an analysis I don't think is done anywhere else in the patent law. And ultimately, let me talk about the safe harbor provision. So this is in 35 U.S.C. Section 121, and if you read the statute, I dare you to figure out what it actually means. Thankfully.
Even if you read all the words of it?
Even if you read all the words, it's interesting if you like Sudoku and, you know, those kind of things, and it's quite challenging. But thankfully, the Federal Circuit has actually interpreted the statute in the Boehringer case in 2010. And basically what it says is the following. If there is a restriction requirement such that the patent office tells you your application is not to one invention, it's to multiple inventions, and therefore you're required to elect one for prosecution in that chain and then file divisionals to prosecute the other inventions. In that situation, you cannot use the divisional against the original application, okay? In Boehringer, the Federal Circuit clarified it doesn't matter if you have divisionals of divisionals or continuations of divisionals. So long as the patent office split up your patent into multiples, obviousness type double patenting is not in play. And it was actually created because before the GATT amendment, the Congress perceived the results of using obviousness type double patenting in cases with restrictions to be unfair to the patentee. Now, there are two requirements. The first one is that both patents, both the patents being challenged and the patent and the expired patents being used to assert double patenting, have to have arisen from the restriction requirement. What that practically means is they're drawn to two different inventions. If they're both on the same invention as the PTO classified it, then the safe harbor doesn't apply. And second, you have consonance. Consonance means that the claims of the patents that are being, the patents being considered have to be drawn to two different inventions with respect to restriction requirement.
So if you have a divisional and then the divisional has a continuation, the divisional and the continuation can be subject to obviousness type double patenting.
I believe that's what Boehringer said.
Okay. Do you have a question, Robert?
You cannot assert obviousness.
Are you protected by 121 from a double patenting defense or not?
So long as you have consonants. So I actually have an example here. So you have a restriction requirement, and the patentee elects the first group, and then he files a divisional to the second group. It doesn't matter if it's a divisional of the divisional or a divisional of the continuation, so long as there has been a division. So you have created two branches of the three. And then you prosecute patents in the separate inventions. So long as the patents are from two different branches of the three, you cannot have obviousness type double patenting. But if they're in the same branch of the three, say you have the original application and a continuation of it, there you can have obviousness type double patenting. That's the situation that the doctrine was actually implemented to prevent.
I think, is this right?
Yep, that's exactly it.
Okay, you want to pass it around? So, question in the back.
So in prosecution, it typically comes up when they're both not expired, right? You'll get the provisional rejection because the two patents on their face would suffer that problem. In litigation, it usually arises after the one that's being asserted has expired, and you're trying to say, well, you have another one that continued on, and that's unfair because you're extending the term. So in the litigation context, one at least is expired.
Anyone else? We got like 1 minute, right? 3 minutes. 3 minutes. Okay. 3 minutes and four things. Okay. Walker process. When I was in law school, which was just a couple, literally just a couple years after you, I think you graduated in
96.
Oh, we're the same year. So it was, you said you'd been practicing since the early 90s. Were you an agent? I'm in cross-examination mode, I'm sorry.
And so I did work before
okay.
I graduated.
So when I was in law school, it was weird that I chose not to take antitrust, or I didn't manage ever to fit it in my schedule, because if you were interested in patent law, like antitrust was one of the things that of course you took because it was a standard defense, except then once I was practicing it, it stopped being a standard defense. So I was really glad that I hadn't bothered taking antitrust in law school because it's a really hard class. It's still out there as an oddball patent defense. Walker process, I'm monitoring a case that is all about Walker process antitrust right now. And it seems to me it is a horrifying set of facts about, if they are true, about the fraud on the patent office in the context of getting a patent that has then been broadly asserted against people. And it's having a really hard time getting out of the pleading stage, right? It's been subject to motion to dismiss after motion to dismiss. Keep an eye on it. It might be possible. If you've got really egregious facts, keep an eye on Walker process, which basically says if there is, it's not inequitable conduct, it is fraud on the patent office, and then you, and knowing fraud on the patent office, and then you go out and assert that patent, then that is a defense to patent infringement.
There's actually one big problem, though, with Walker process claims. You also have to do the antitrust part of the analysis.
Yeah, and I didn't take
you need to have market
so
power.
Get it. Yeah.
So I've actually had a case that we won with proof fraud on the patent office, and that was upheld, went all the way up to the Supreme Court. The inequitable conduct part, fraud on the patent office was upheld. They said, Walker process? No, you didn't. The patentee didn't have market power. And remember, for under antitrust laws, there is a complete exemption from antitrust violations for to the scope of the patent.
He took antitrust law.
So it's actually very hard to prove this defense. It's a great defense you can prove because you get antitrust damages as the defendant.
Troubled. Yeah. I know that.
Yeah.
All right, 1 minute left.
Lightning round.
Latches.
So latches is a defense that's always pled. I've never actually seen it truly litigated in any case I've done.
Has anybody actually litigated latches in a meaningful way?
Wow.
You got three.
Three people.
Four.
Four.
Four. Okay, five.
And I guess the
it's
result was there was no latches in your cases? Anybody actually
anybody
got a patent killed
latches?
Because of latches? Right.
One.
One. Wow.
All right, talk to that guy at the break.
Right. And, you know, but basically, Latches says if the patentee has waited for 6 years.
Equitable estoppel. That's another one. There's a lot of words on the slides. You have the slides. And then handguards, another antitrust thing. So, oh, do we have more words on that? We have some words on this. So, lots of oddballs. And keep an eye on all of them. Read all the words.